everybody, and welcome to Second Sunday Crime. If you keep up with such things, you'll know that this is the first new edition of Second Sunday Crime. I was on hiatus for 2 years, but now I'm back. And I'm really excited to be back, especially when I have a wonderful author like Andre Frieden to talk to. Andre is a thriller writer. He's written, how many books have you written?
Four and three in this series.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And a little bit about Andre. There's much more on his website, and he's got a really storied career. It will behoove you to check it out. He was born in Senegal, Africa, then spent several years in India, Switzerland, and the UK before emigrating with his parents to the southern United States. After high school, he returned to his native Switzerland to serve in the U.S. Swiss Army, where he trained as a marksman. He later came back to the U.S. to complete undergraduate and graduate studies and earned his two law degrees, a pilot's license and scuba instructor license. Today, aside from his thriller writing career, you'll find him practicing law as one of the country's preeminent technology IP lawyers. Hey, Andre.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I'm delighted to be the first one as you relaunched it. So thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
No, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure, especially when we have such a great book as The Pyongyang Option. Tell us about it. I noticed it's set like 14 years ago. And why is that?
So I visited Pyongyang a few years ago, but I decided to set this novel in 2005 because it's at the time where The Serpent's Game, the prior book, ends. So I wanted an immediate continuation for the character, not for the story. These are standalone novels, but the series continues the same hero and some other characters. And because of the extraordinary circumstances and life changes that my character went through during Katrina and immediately after Katrina in the prior book, I thought this continuation was best to place right after that book. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like you said, it presents a challenge because why would someone read about North Korea, which is half the setting in this book, today? Right. It's in 2005. It was the previous leader, Kim Jong-il.
Right.
Different circumstances, different tensions with the United States. So over the course of writing it in the past year and a half, I found a magical way. And it wasn't just my idea. It was also my amazing editor, Julia Borchers. Mm-hmm. So together we came up with a solution of how to keep it set in 2005, but bring it to a live, very real situation that's valid today. So there is a twist in the story that brings it to the current events that we have today, despite it being based in 2005.
Well, okay. Well, hopefully we can discuss that. I thought it was mostly because both North Korea and Ukraine, which is where the book is also set, are in the news today for other reasons.
Correct. In fact, when I, back in 2013, when The Serpent's Game came out, the book that I had planned as the next one was Letter from Istanbul, which actually is coming out in about 11 months. So The Pyongyang Option was sort of a book of opportunity to squeeze into otherwise would have been, a very set plan of rolling out these books, partly because I visited the country, partly because Ukraine, shortly after my visit, within 6 months of my visit, fell into what is essentially a civil war. And
when
North
did you
Korea,
visit? When did you visit Ukraine?
In 2012.
Okay. All right.
So shortly after that, the chaos started.
Mm-hmm.
And North Korea also always had tensions with the U.S. during the Bush administration, during Obama, but was especially in the news ever since the Trump administration took over. So I thought it was just a great timing to bring this kind of thriller into the market. And they're, you know, I've met authors who have written both fiction and nonfiction about North Korea, but none of them have been there. And I think I've tried to add that sense of reality and realism from someone who's walked the streets of Pyongyang and seen what things really look like.
Well, I was going to wait till later to ask you this question, but how did you get into North Korea?
So at the time, I was there in 2009. At the time, it was legal for U.S. citizens to visit, but they were restricted to the capital. They couldn't leave the capital. They had different minders. There were more restrictions on them. So I went in with my Swiss passport. And as a non-U.S. citizen in North Korea, you have much greater access.
All right.
So I visited the second largest city, Kaesong. I went to the DMZ on the communist side. So I had a little bit more exposure to the country. Mm-hmm. You still are surrounded by minders. You still, can't take every picture that you want. They will, take your camera and erase the pictures. So you have to be a little bit clever and sneaky if you want to bring back things from North Korea.
Yeah. So how did you take pictures?
So obviously I can never return to North Korea at this point.
Even with your Swiss passport?
No, I can't because of the books that I've written. So
Soon after
my travels, I published a photography book on North Korea, just because it was just such a fascinating place to visit, and I wanted to do something with all the pictures that I took. Many of the pictures would not be approved by the minders, but I took them anyway, using smaller cameras and the larger cameras as distractions. So there are ways that you can take pictures. You just have to be discreet about it.
Wow.
And then a few years later, obviously, I started writing and have now published The Pyongyang Option, which, as you've read in the story, is certainly something the North Korean government would not approve,
to say the least.
And in fact, I've been warned by several people to be more careful as I visit locations in Asia. So I was in Beijing in December and took additional precautions. Even though the book had not been published, there were some marketing materials already out circulating. So I have to be a little bit more careful because of this book.
Do you have a bodyguard?
No.
Okay. Well, tell us, we'll get back to your career and all that, because it's really, really, I want to talk about it. Tell us about Jonathan Brooks and give us the backstory on him and why did you choose Katrina to focus on?
Mm-hmm. So Jonathan is, he's a lawyer. He's a maritime lawyer in New Orleans. He embodies many of the things that I feel are important.
Why did you choose New Orleans?
I went to law school in New Orleans.
Ah.
So I got my Juris Doctor there at Loyola. Had a really a transformative experience because it was law school and because it was New Orleans and a very unusual American city. I just really fell in love with the place. And I felt that, building a character and anchoring every book to New Orleans, even if it's just a few scenes, brings back some good memories and is almost a duty I feel that I'm fulfilling to keep that memory and experience inside me. So New Orleans also offers so many diverse things for thriller and mystery writing that it's a very good setting. So Jonathan Brooks is a maritime lawyer, and in many ways he's just living his life, trying to earn a living, represent clients, do the right thing. But as these books come out, he's thrown in these extraordinary circumstances. And the vast majority of the stories are espionage, but there's a seed that has a legal thriller element. Mm-hmm. But these are not legal thrillers, but they have an element of these thrillers, whether it's a courtroom battle, negotiating contracts with strange individuals, that sort of thing. But they are espionage novels.
That comes across very clearly. Is that because of your proficiency in intelligence generally? I mean, in Pyongyang Option, I was reading things that are way past Five Eyes and GCHQ programs. Where did you learn all of this?
Well, over the years, I've interviewed former intelligence officials, military intelligence officials from several countries. I've also spent a lot of time researching the topics in open source, and to the extent that I can get, some confidential information, I will try to get it. And this circle of friends, colleagues, and other professionals, some of them that I've made through my legal contacts, mm-hmm. have been invaluable in giving me a piece of information. And even if they don't disclose everything in great detail, I can collect enough information and sort of reverse engineer a particular activity or path to that information. So I try to be, I write my novels with obviously a general audience in mind, but I also write it so that it can fulfill the scrutiny that will come from fellow lawyers and from those in the military and intelligence and law enforcement community. So, and those are some of the toughest critics. So I try to write so they don't question it.
Of course. That's like me and my crime thrillers. If I write something that's not police procedurally correct, I'll never hear the end of it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So one thing I wanted to ask you, Jonathan ends up, that doesn't end up, but one of his stops is in a kind of sad, sorry hotel in Kiev. Did you stay in a hotel like that? I mean, the description was just so right on.
I have, in that particular case, I've been to the hotel, but I did not stay in that hotel. I stayed in a much nicer hotel. But I've been to many ex-Soviet Union hotels in my travels. And how I described that room was really my experience at 5-6 different hotels during my studies in Russia. And I also stayed in dorms, at university dorms in Russia. I collect all this information and make it as real as possible.
Yeah, well, as I said when I gave you the blurb for the book, your description of setting is unlike any I've ever read. It's just so accurate and so specific. I know that you've been there. I know that you've looked at that hotel room. I know that you've looked at, okay, now I do want to, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but it's in the middle of the book, I don't think it would be, but he ends up in Chernobyl. And, in the Ukraine, and where they're doing, he's doing some research and he's talking to people. First of all, how did you get into the restricted zone of Chernobyl?
Believe it or not, there are some people crazy enough who want to have some recreational radiation. So you can take a tour. A fabulous tour company that I used. And they will take you for about a 3-hour tour, two of which are in the radioactive area where, they give you as much cautionary advice as possible. Don't touch the soil, don't put anything in your mouth, don't, try to stay on paved ground,
wow.
That sort of, don't walk near sewer grates or other cracks in the pavement, things like that. And some of the tourists wore protective suits, I thought if I exercise at least some good judgment, I won't have to wear that horrible outfit. But I was in the zone, which includes the current reactor number 4, which is dormant. And at the time, they were still building the new sarcophagus. Because the old one has been leaking for a long time, and the new one is also part of the story. And then a significant part of the Ukraine setting takes place in Pripyat, which is a nearby abandoned town of 50,000 inhabitants that was evacuated in 1986 after the explosion. But it was evacuated 2 days after the explosion.
Oh, no.
So, unfortunately, many people had exposure, radioactive exposure, with long-term consequences. So, but it's a fascinating visit to see Pripyat, because it looks like Evanston. You know, Evanston is a good example. You know, it's a mid-sized town, modern infrastructure, actually quite modern for Soviet days.
Was it built for employees of Chernobyl?
Mostly, yes.
Yeah.
So it was very modern. It was built in really a field with 9 to 12 story apartment buildings, large common places, gymnasiums, grocery stores, quite modern infrastructure. So to go there now, 30 years after it's been abandoned, where you have trees in the middle of a stadium, where you have this, you know, nature taking over, you know, a modern infrastructure, is eerie. It's a very strange feeling and apocalyptic in many ways.
Were you advised to take precautions there as well?
Well, especially because there's still significant level of radiation in non-paved areas and in the water table, which then goes into the sewer systems. So that's where you walk around carrying a dosimeter. And it goes off quite loudly when you hold a dosimeter over a sewer grate, for example. So there is dangerous level of radiation in some parts of the city, and you just have to be careful.
Mm. Boy, you have a lot of guts, more than me. I would not go near those places.
Yeah, it's probably not the best thing to do, but I was driven by curiosity.
Wow. Jonathan apparently, and not in this book, but maybe in the prior books, spent time in Moscow and also Central America. What was he doing there in those two places?
Yeah, so the Central America portion was immediately after Katrina. So the Serpent's Game starts 2 days before Katrina strikes New Orleans, and he's sort of obligated to stay in the city, not evacuate, in order to help an old friend find someone who's drowned. Mm-hmm. So that starts really an espionage story that later shifts to Central America, to Venezuela, to Panama, to Nicaragua, and a little bit to Cuba. And then the prior book, Tranquility Denied, which is set in 1996, not long after the Soviet Union collapsed. The two main settings there are Scandinavia, mostly Stockholm and the island of Gotland in the Baltic, and then Moscow.
Okay.
And the Moscow part was, to me, the most interesting because it was, I studied in Moscow during law school. I had, really fond memories of exploring that city, and I was eager to put it into a novel, and Tranquility Denied was the first one that featured Moscow.
When you were studying what were you studying in law school in Moscow?
So it was a summer exchange program with Moscow State University, with my university in New Orleans. So I studied commercial law, I studied the changing laws of Russia as they began to adopt a new real estate code, new laws on business and banking. So it was sort of a comparative law study of the old Soviet system and the new Russia at the time.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the story of Pyongyang option. Pyongyang option. I'll get it right.
So it starts with Jonathan Brooks comes back from his ordeal in Central America, which is where the Serpents game ends. And he comes back to a looted and pillaged law firm. He has essentially no clients left except one. Everything is a disaster. His home is boarded up. His car is destroyed. His law partners have left the state and aren't returning, are incommunicado. He doesn't know where to turn. It's an absolute disaster. And then his relationship with his ex-wife is also another issue that's weaved into this. But fortunately, he has one client left who's willing to give him some work, albeit it's not the easiest thing in the world. It's essentially fly to Ukraine and see if you can get a business deal done for me. And he really is forced to do it because he has no other ways to get by financially. So that's how the story starts. And he ends up in Kiev trying to negotiate a deal with, some really murky rules and a strange opposing party.
And then the guy who's supposed to know all the answers, who is an American, never shows up. Right.
A critical piece of this is having your chief technology officer at the table, and he doesn't show up. And as Jonathan investigates what has happened, he realizes the guy has been taken. It's not just a simple disappearance.
Right, right. Well, I have to tell you, you have a pretty large body count in this. I suppose thrillers do that, but I was impressed. I was just like, okay. Like the one that I was sorry about was there was a woman that he's getting fairly, she's getting friendly with him. Who knows? Maybe she was a spy. Maybe she wasn't. But Ayla. Is that how you pronounce her name? That was a spoiler. Sorry about that. How did you get such specific information about the U.S. Whitney, which was the C-41 center ship in the Black Sea? Or was that your imagination?
So actually, I've studied that ship quite a bit for another story that I'm writing. And then I have two former Navy officials, Department of the Navy officials, and then one former officer who served on a different ship, but with similar capabilities. So they helped me sort of look at some of the language that I used in describing the setting. And I looked at a lot of photographs from the Pentagon. So the Pentagon publishes an enormous volume of photographs, and actually they're really very interesting. They give you a lot of information, even if they black out some of the screens in a command center. You can still decipher a lot of how things work. So it was a combination of people who've been in that environment reviewing how I described it, and also my own independent research.
Wow, that's great. Now, does that ship specifically trawl the Black Sea?
It's been in the Black Sea, I believe, twice in the last few years. It is a very sore point for the Russian armed forces when that ship goes into the Black Sea, because it not only has radar and electronic intelligence and signals intelligence capabilities, it amalgamates all the other resources and satellite reconnaissance to get a really big regional picture of what the Russian military forces are doing. So they don't like it, and they survey the ship. They have flybys. They have other ships to spy on that ship, and it's always annoying for the Russians to have that vessel.
Do they agitate
in the Baltic?
Do they take any kind of
fight? I don't believe they've done it to this vessel, but they have to other vessels in the Black Sea and have their anti-ship jets do flybys, usually unarmed, just to not be too provocative, but they will do some flybys and, you know, pass within a few hundred feet of a vessel.
Okay, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about. You talk about Negev Desert Unit 820. How did you find that?
So there's quite a bit of public information now, open source information about that unit. It's still, you know, quite.
What is it?
Yeah, so it's the equivalent of the NSA for the Israeli Defense Forces. Mm-hmm. They're actually quite good. They have a lot of signals and electronic intelligence resources. And they also have cooperation with the NSA and a little bit less with GCHQ and other intelligence services. Right. So it's a very professional team. They also have conscripts, and that's actually the character in that scene is a conscript.
Really?
Who is fluent in Korean. And why is that relevant? A few years ago, Israel leveled a nuclear reactor that Syria and North Korea were building in Syria proper. And that was a result, in part, of the intelligence from Unit 8200, which has at least one Korean linguist. And that's what I portrayed in the book.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was going to ask you whether, we know now that North Koreans and Syria were working together to build a nuclear reactor. But back in 2005, was that known? Or
it was suspected.
I think it's Linda, right?
From what I've read, it was suspected that they had intercepted components. Right. They had intelligence that components were being flown in through Damascus and by ship. And there were breaches of laptops and networks at North Korean embassies in Europe that also pointed to that kind of secretive activity.
Right.
But it wasn't really until they had someone on the ground taking the photographic evidence that they knew that there was a reactor there, for sure.
Now, you, radioactive poison polonium makes an appearance in this story, and you're talking about low doses, and what is it, Livyenko, right?
Livyenko,
he was the Russian, he was poisoned and ultimately passed away because of it. Is there such a thing as a low dose of polonium?
Well, that's the funny part in this story is that without revealing who the villain is, there is this view that this villain is not judicious, is not cautious, is doing things without a full understanding of the action's lethality or risks. Sort of careless, right? So that's sort of the irony of whether a dose of polonium can be used, without a lethal effect. So it just adds to building that villain as sort of a reckless, dangerous person.
Right. And you know, there were series of bad guys in Ukraine and in North Korea. And even, some of the Americans were suspect. That's what I loved about the story. It really, no one is perfect. No one is a hero, except for Brooks, Jonathan, of course.
That's sort of how I approach all my thrillers. I feel that I stay away from stereotypes as much as possible. And I feel that almost everyone has something in their closet. Dirty hands. I don't believe that just by nationality or affiliation to an organization that you are either right or wrong, good or evil. So so all my characters, from a good or evil standpoint, or ethical or unethical, they fall into, you know, varying shades of gray. I stay away from black and white as much as possible.
Yeah, no, that did come across. What would you say Jonathan's flaws are?
I think in some ways he's idealistic. And I must say I was the same when I left law school. I had a very idealistic view of the world, of law and order and justice and doing the right thing. And over time, you just pick up some cynicism along the way, and you see things, the corruption, the reality of the world we live in. And I think he still clings to some of that that idealism, perhaps to his own detriment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's step back for a second. Let me ask you, why did you start writing in the first place? What drew you to writing thrillers? What drew you to writing?
I always enjoyed poetry, actually, when I was a kid. And in college, I took some fiction writing, but not seriously, because I pursued a technical career, actually. So I got my master's in molecular biology. My research was really in, protein structuring, mathematical and biological at the same time.
So then why didn't you go to law school after that?
I went to law school to become a patent lawyer. And as a patent lawyer, you have to have a technical background. Mm. So over time, my career went into technology law in a broader sense. So a lot of my early clients were pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies, and then they eventually grew to software. That's what I do mostly today.
My late husband was an IP lawyer.
Really?
Yeah, in software licensing and stuff like
So that's what I do day in, day out. And so my travels really are responsible for driving me to becoming an author. I traveled, I wrote short stories, I wrote a lot of diaries about my travels. And at some point I realized, why not collect all this and turn this into something, more useful and use all my travel experience for something different. And that's sort of the path that I've taken. And a lot of my books and settings are come about because of a place I visited and rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Well, how many countries now? It was 65 a while back.
Yeah, now it's about 80.
Oh, my.
Including some that don't exist anymore, like East Germany.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. I'm jealous. I think my high point is like 22.
So. Well, you just came back from Vietnam, which is an amazing place.
Yeah, Vietnam, Cambodia, and a few days in Bangkok.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, but 90 countries is 80 or 90 countries is pretty well past what most tourists do. So,
but I lived in others as well. So so when I visit countries, I want to see off the beaten path places as much as possible. And now that I have my series, I can't detach my writing from my travel. So. Right. Wherever I go, even though the purpose might just be curiosity or vacation, I have at least one eye on everything I see to turn it into a novel.
God, I have so many more questions, but we're running out of time. How did you learn the craft of fiction?
After I got serious and wrote my first standalone mystery back in 2004, I decided to take some fiction writing courses at Columbia College, and I was thrilled to interact with many crime fiction authors that, who are around today and very successful, like Jamie Frevoletti, Marcus Seki, and others. Mm-hmm. And Patricia Rosemore also took me under her wing in sort of a side group of students to help them flourish. So I'm so thankful for her time and her belief that I could be a successful author. So I owe a lot to her and to the group that I interacted with.
Yeah, well, you have a great writing style. It kept my interest the whole time. So, okay, I'm going to close with what, you know, we typically say what's next for you. But before I get to what's next, one that's coming out, I guess, in 11 months, what country have you not been to that you would love to go to?
Syria. I would like to go to Syria. I think I almost went 2 years ago, and it's just not safe enough.
Right.
So although it would be interesting, I will wait a couple of more years before going. But I think Syria would fit in perfectly for some upcoming books.
Sure. Okay. And now what's coming up next?
So Letter from Istanbul comes out in about 11 months. It is set in Istanbul and in Mumbai. And the book after that, which was just recently announced, is Midnight in Delhi. Mm. And it's very recently that I thought of this book because I have spent almost a year in India over the last four years, mostly for work, but I've taken the opportunity to really see so many different parts of India, over these 17 trips that I've taken so far. So it's certainly something I'm itching not only to write about India, but also the Indian market has so much opportunity in the mystery and thriller space that I want to tap into that market.
Sure.
And the best way to do it is to have a novel set in India.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Although I think, you know, they have to lower the prices so much for India that sometimes the investment isn't quite.
But the ebook market is growing very rapidly.
Oh, good. I hope that's true for all of us. Well, Andre, thank you. No, are you bilingual or trilingual?
So I speak obviously English, French, Portuguese, and Spanish, and a little bit of Russian.
Okay. Wow. Well, I want to have you back when the new book comes out, the Istanbul book comes out, because I've only been able to really talk to you about half the things I wanted to. But thank you so much for spending this time. And listeners, do read the Pyongyang Option. It's a great story. You will not be disappointed. Promise. So, Andre, thank you again. It's been delightful.
Thank you, Libby. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to seeing you again.
We will see you again soon. Well, that wraps up our first show of the relaunch of Second Sunday Crime. Glad you could be with us. I'll be back again next week with another interview. I'm Libby Hellman, and I need to remind you that this is a trademarked, copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.